Good morning. This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team, and today we are interviewing David Wayne Calloway. It is May 10th. We are at the Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. This is the local 602 Historical Committee. We'll introduce the team first.
John Fedewa.
Doug Rademacher. Okay, today is David's interview. David, would you please state your name and spell it for the record?
It's David Wayne Callwhite, K-A-L-L-W-E-I-T.
And what is your address?
500 West Geneva Drive, DeWitt, Michigan.
Okay. Can you tell me, do you have, are you married?
Oh, yes.
And do you have any children?
Two boys, Robbie and Trevor.
And what are their ages?
Trevor is 23 and Robbie is 20.
And what is your educational background?
I have a high school diploma and I have almost a full year of college on top of that.
And your military service, did you have any?
Came close, but no.
And tell me, David, what did your parents do for a living?
My father was a minister for over 25 years, and then from there he went on to work for Art Van until he finally did retire as a furniture repairman. My mother, she was an unpaid secretary to the church for all those years, and then she worked for Estes Furniture here in Lansing until she retired. She went from Estes to Lazy Boy and then retired from there.
Would you please state what your job is today? What do you do?
Okay, I work for Local 602 UAW, and I've never seen a job description of my particular job. I've asked for one several times over the years, but I've just never given one. I kind of put it into the category of anything that needs to get done, I'm there to do it. I've done everything from sweep the floors to answer telephone calls to go get donuts. I mean, anything that needs to get done that can't quite get finished, I'm asked to do.
Okay. David, you did hire into Fisher Body, is that correct?
That's correct.
Would you please tell me what you did before you hired into Fisher Body?
Okay. My family and I moved from North Dakota in June of 71 to a little town of Sunfield, Michigan, just 30 miles west of Lansing. And when I came to the high school for my senior year, the high school required 18 credits to graduate, and I already had 21 going into my senior year. And so all I had to do was pass the U.S. government class, and I could graduate. And coming from, going into a new high school in my senior year, as far as I was concerned, I needed to get my one credit for my government class, and I wanted to go on with my life. So from there, I was able to get a job at the cafeteria at Fisher Body. And I started in the last week of January of 72 there. And then the third week of May, I hired in at Fisher Body. So I was still going to high school when I actually hired in at Fisher.
And how did you know that Fisher Body was hiring in the cafeteria? What took you there?
We have a good friend, a good acquaintance named Bruce DeLand, who thought that would be a good place to start. And by there, I was able to, you learn some of the staff, and I wouldn't say I was on a first name basis with the with Jerry Brooks, but he knew me, and I knew him, and he's who I had to get through to get hired. And so every day I would be, or every other day anyway, I would be talking to Jerry.
So he was in charge of employment?
Yes.
And so you worked in the cafeteria for a while. You saw you saw the line before you had to go to work on it. So what what was that like to walk in from what would sound like a small town in Minnesota to Sunfield, Michigan, into a facility where they build automobiles? Can you describe that day when you walked in?
It's incredibly different worlds. Even to go back there, it's almost like going back in time. And I'm not meaning to be negative about this because it's a wonderful way of life. But in North Dakota there, there's just no... In North Dakota, if you're not directly working for one of the two Air Force bases, if you're not in the minerals on the west side of the state, or if you're not a huge farmer, there are no jobs. So when we came to Michigan, it was so that we kids could find jobs. And the auto industry, and with the protection that I knew that the UAW had, seemed like a great place to have a career. So I was wanting to do whatever it took to achieve that goal. And starting in the cafeteria was where I started.
Was the cafeteria located on the main level, or where it was when the plant closed?
Okay, there were the cafeteria is upstairs, but where the coffee was made and the donuts and the sandwiches were brought to where so when they had the wagons, was down at a different level, and I don't know exactly what level that was at, but we. You know, we had a room, big room where we kept everything, and it was funny how everybody was so particular with the food and everything. But you know, we had to check all of our wrappers for our donuts and especially our pies to make sure the rats hadn't gotten into them. And everybody was so fussy about the coffee cups, but they didn't know. But the stick that we measured the coffee was always falling on the floor. You rinse it off and keep on going.
You said a wagon. Can you describe what a wagon is?
A wagon is basically just a big serving cart, really is what it is. It's bigger than, I can't remember how big they were. They had to be at least 4 or 5 foot long and maybe 24 inches or 30 inches wide. I don't really remember. It's been so many years ago. But you'd have a great big urn at the end of it for coffee. And it was incredible how good you got at math because when you pulled up for their wagon break, they had 6 minutes, if I remember correctly. And you would serve 25, 30 people, maybe more, in that six-minute period. And you always had to be, you had to be counting your money, and you had to be collecting your money, and you had to keep track of everybody who took what to make sure somebody wasn't misleading you and stealing stuff off the cart because you were responsible for that. So it was a big change from going from a little town in North Dakota to being in the wagon, but that was the big city, and that's the way you do it. And if you were wanting to succeed, you either got on board or got kicked to the curb.
Okay. This Mr. DeLand led you to another Mr. Brooks, and you were... came the day they asked you if you wanted a job. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I was... Bruce is a very good friend, and I owe Bruce a lot. The way I understand what happened was Weathorn, who was the plant manager at the time, Bruce DeLand was the zone for the skilled trades at the time, and something on his desk got broke, and Bruce took it and got it fixed, and he turned to Bruce and says, I owe you for this. And he says, well, I got somebody that needs a job. And from that point, I was, between my bugging Brooks and the Weathorn, I was asked to show up for my physical. I was told directly that, see, this was the first week in May, and I was told that I had to quit my job at the cafeteria, and then in 2 weeks I could show up. But there had to be a space there between us because they didn't want everybody in the cafeteria banging on everybody trying to get a job when I was getting a job. And it came to be a very crucial 2 weeks that was very unfortunate for me anyway now after all this time, but that's how I got in. Bruce DeLand had a great deal of influence as far as me getting into the plant.
So you gave your 2 weeks, you disappeared from the regular cafeteria staff, and now you've entered the building. You had the physical that day, or did it...
I took the physical that day. I showed up, I forget what time, I want to say 2 o'clock. In fact, I had to get out of school early to make the physical. And that night, I went to work.
So now you've been there, like I said, the cafeteria. You did this wagon thing where you brought product out to the workers. It's your first day in the Fisher Body plant. Who came to get you? Who was your supervisor? And what did you do? Where'd they take you?
Okay, I was down in the solder booth, as a silicone bronze booth. And it was very obvious that I was going to have a great deal of problems learning how to move that lead around the way it needed to be done. And so from there, they moved me from to the grinding booth, where I spent most of my time in the early days. That's almost an art form as far as I'm concerned. But I did my best and I did what I could. And, you know, because I knew within time I would learn how to do that, but they needed somebody then that could do it. So what they did is I took the guy out of the grinding booth and let him do that, and I went to the grinding booth. And it was just an absolute difference, because I can remember the first night that I worked at Fisher, I worked at 10-3. That's 10 hours and 18 minutes. And I got home, I want to say 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had to be at school by 8 o'clock. And that was a long day. Because first thing it is, as soon as I got out of school, I had to turn back around and go do the whole thing the next night. So I only had 3 weeks of school left before I was out, but that was a long 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Now there's something called a probationary period. It's generally 90 days, and then you are considered a permanent worker. Can mm-hmm. you describe what it was like to, you said you... 3 weeks to the end of school, what was it like to get that 90 days, and did you have any trouble with that, with management or anybody in the plant?
No, everybody, I never had a problem with you know, Dad was always such a hard worker that they say that's a reflection of what kind of worker you're going to be, I guess. But, you know, I knew this is what I wanted, and I had to do what I had to do to make this work. I had at times, at that time, of dreams and aspirations of even becoming a foreman someday. So I would always be there early and be ready. And being in that booth, that grinding booth, was so hard because you had all this equipment on, you know, the safety stuff on.
And what type of safety equipment?
Well, you had a hood on, and you had your safety glasses on, you had your hood on, and you had these coveralls. Well, What you would do is strip down to your shorts and your boots and then put these coveralls on because it was so hot. And then it was just really, you know, I complained to the foreman about, you know, because we were only given 3 coveralls a week. Well, I felt like a porcupine every night because this wire brush you would use prior to grinding would literally be sticking in you. And he goes, you know, this is silly. And he gave me a whole fistful of oh, the acquisition forms. Okay, what the correct name of them are?
Transfer slips?
No, no.
Oh, acquisition, to go get something from the safety
right.
shop?
Yeah. So every day I got a new set of coveralls. But the foreman did that over and above, and I'm quite sure he could have gotten in trouble if his higher-ups found out about it. But I needed those because I'd be full of pins or full of those needle from that wire brush every day.
Was that brush in a hand brush, or was that a tool?
It was an air tool. It spun around in a circle, and when you'd hit the car, those would break off. And some of them would be impale you right through your coveralls. And, you know, it was... I thought I was very much appreciative of that. You know, that's something I felt like, you know, the big bad foremans are supposed to be so vicious. Well, he was going out of his way to... You know, his comment to me was, the next contract, you're going to get this anyway, so why shouldn't you get it now? You need it. And he made sure I always had them. So he says, don't tell anybody, and don't advertise this, but, you know, and I obviously did as I was told.
So fill in a few blanks here. What was your hire-in date?
My hire-in date. I really can't tell you that. It was the It was the third week in May. That's all I can remember.
And you said you went to the booth, which is in the body shop.
Correct.
Can you tell me how long you worked in the booth and the body shop?
Oh, wow. These...
Did you get your 90 days there? How's that?
Okay, I didn't quite get my 90 days, and I was laid off. And then from there, I was called back. I almost lost my seniority time for time there, but I was called back. And from there, I was put into trim.
Can you describe the difference of going to the trim department then?
Incredible difference. It was cooler. It was so much cleaner. I mean, you know, down the body shop, you saw the air you breathed back then. And it was so hot down there. And especially being in that booth, in the coveralls. But in the body shop, it was just, I mean, or in the, I was in body wires is actually what I was in. In trim, but in body wires. And it was just so difficult for me to keep up with the line because we ran all the body wires on all four doors and two doors that went from the front end of the vehicle to the back on the rider side of the car. And my partner, and we would do every other car. But if we've got a couple of Vista Cruisers in a row there, or station wagons in a row, man, I was in trouble because I couldn't keep up. I'd work as hard as I could, and just, you know, and I had a partner that we worked out that, you know, when we ran into that, he'd help me out with this, and then times got slight, I would build stock for him, so we could equal each other out as far as workload. And we would complain to the committee man, and there's nothing that he could really do, but we complained enough that they guaranteed us, quote unquote, that they would space these station wagons out farther apart. So even management recognized that it was tough to do this. And that never really worked. But I can remember, I would get there real early, you know, as much as an hour before the line, because I'd build up all my stock. Because if I didn't, because you see, you had to look at the manifest.
What's a manifest?
The manifest is what wires go, or what product goes into the car. And every car is... You know, there's probably, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 different styles or wires. You know, like some of them would have power windows and some of them wouldn't. Some of them would be two-door, some would be four-door. Then the wagon, it had all these wires in there. Well, anyway, you had to look at the manifest, run to your bench, build up the particular wires for it, then put them in and install them. And, you know, in each door that you have, you've got a boot that you've got to fit in place. Well, what I would do is I would come in really early, and I would build up maybe an hour's worth of supply or different, you know, because I knew which wires would be needed. And so that way that would help me up as far as keeping up with the line. And it used to make me so frustrated because I'd have 45 minutes to an hour worth of stock left up for the next guy in the next shift. And I'd come in the next day, and I'd have one body wire. You know?
Now, I want to separate something. You just mentioned a wire for a wagon. Now, let's separate the two. What wagon are you referring to this time? Not the one with the food on it.
No, this is it's like a station wagon.
Can you tell me what models you built at that time, and what was the nameplate? Because I think
it was an Oldsmobile, but I can't remember the body style. I'm wanting to say it's a Vista Cruiser, but I can't be for sure.
Okay. And what other vehicles were built?
I didn't, on the one line, they built 88s and 98s, and the line that I was on, we built Cutlasses, I think, and then station wagons.
Okay.
That's as I remember it, anyway.
I knew they had separate lines, so there's lots of different parts. Lots of different, it's called model mix, and to adjust that so that the work was even would be very difficult.
And when they talk about building, you know, five or six different, entirely different vehicles, I kind of shake my head and going, boy, I hope they can do it, and I hope they have the time, because I remember just the few different changes that I dealt with were so dramatically different. But, you know, maybe I should back up here just a second because I kind of was, when I got laid off from Fisher, I got hired in as a area hire at the engine plant at Oldsmobile. And I had 8 carburetors that I had to install. The engine would come around and I would look at the manifest and I had to choose between these 8 carburetors. I had to set up the carburetor on, set 2 bolts in, and start 1. And I did 258 of those an hour. I mean, it's just impossible to do that. I know that sounds like it's just, but, you know, you were flying. And I remember, too, that I had a really good foreman there, too. I was having just this horrible night. My future wife at that time and I had broken up. And I was having a horrible time mentally. The thing with it is, you set this carburetor on, and they would finish dressing the engine, and they wouldn't find out if this was the right carburetor on or not until it was all the way around on the other side of the factory, practically. And so putting on the wrong carburetor was a big deal because they'd have to take all the stuff off. And the foreman comes to me, he says, Wayne, he says, you missed a carburetor. I says, I did. He says, okay, I'll try to do better. And about 20 minutes later, he comes back over and says, you missed the second one. And he says, I want you to come over here. I need to talk to you. So he took me to his office. He says, what's the problem? And I told him, you know, broken up with my girlfriend, and I had this problem. I was doing my best. I truly was. But it was just a horrible time for me, you know, because I had planned on marrying her. And he says, well, you've got to do better. He says, if I could let you go for the night, I would, but I don't have the manpower. I says, all right. And about 45 minutes later, he comes back over and he pulls me off the line again. He says, Wayne, he says, you know, you missed another one. He says, I understand you're having a hard time. I understand this is a terrible time for you, but he says, understand this. He says, you miss another one and I'm going to cut your nuts off.
Not fire you. He's going to take just, something
he,
personal.
He was going to cut my
he
nuts.
He
was going
to take this
that's
personal.
That's what it, you know. And thing that is, I understood his position. He understood my position. But in the way, a scheme of things, nobody cared. Because he cared, I cared, but the job still had to get done. Never missed another one the rest of the night.
And that girl wouldn't want you if you didn't have those.
Well, and the thing that is, I appreciated that foreman so much because he truly cared. But in his experience of whatever you want to call it, finally found a way to get me to perform the way I needed to get the job done. It's not that he didn't care, it's just it had to get done.
Well, then I need to ask then, David, did you call yourself Wayne, did you get your 90 days in at the engine plant then?
Well, before I got my 90 days in there, I got called back to Fisher. And
there's a hiring boom going on, eh?
Well, the plants were, you know, back and forth. And, you know, I was wanting to stay with Fisher because it was a cleaner plant. And I liked that better. So I went back to Fisher, and that's when I went to the body wires. And I worked there. And then right through the winter, and then I worked changeover, and that was an experience.
Well, before you go too far, I want to ask you then. So you've hired in Fisher, you've worked the body shop, you've seen metal and air you can see and breathe. You've been to the other side of the town, the sister plant that finished up the vehicles, built the engines, and now you were going to go back to Fisher, but you only knew of the body shop. So what was it like to walk in and see this trim department that you'd never
seen?
Well,
it was so... The first thing I noticed is that it was so bright and really good lights. And the body shop was always so dark. You know, they back then, that's when they literally called it the jungle. And that's because of all the... You know, body shop had all those welders that they had. And all the hoses hanging from all over, and they changed the points all the time because of the points being burned up on the welders. And it was, you know, it wasn't the worst place I'd ever worked, but It was a tough place to work. It was not a healthy place. You know, I would assume the paint department would be worse than that because you're breathing all those fumes all the time. But being in the going upstairs, it was just so much cooler, and you could see what you're doing. And you know, you had more. I felt like you had more responsibility because of those body wires, and they had to be right. And I was glad to be there.
Would you tell me about your coworkers? Did they embrace you as a new worker? Was there any pranks or initiations that you had to go through, or that you did go through? And if so, did you give them back?
There was always pranks going on, and to this day, the stuff that went on would be people would be fired over in a heartbeat. There was a girl down the end, you know, we had put body wires. We were also putting the different putties, the different cracks and things. It was another person's job. And the girl down around the corner, she loved the attention. She couldn't get enough attention. And so the guys, they just fed on that. And one of her jobs was is to open the trunk, and she had to do something in the trunk. I don't remember what it was. But I remember one time they took this clay, this putty stuff, you know, they formed it into two testicles with a penis. And then they got this white stuff. They poured it over the top. Of course, she opens this thing up, and she was just so embarrassed. She just ate that up. I mean, we try to do something like that today, people would be fired left and right. But it was a different time back then, because I don't know if you want to call it more tolerant or less tolerant, but it was... you know, people helped each other, and you know, I can remember the co-workers were, you know, there's always the cold one once in a while, but I remember always warm, fuzzy feelings about that time.
How old were you when you hired in to fish your body?
Oh, wow. How old was I?
Were you a young man?
I was 19 when I hired in. And... you know, there were several of us that hired in that were close to the same seniority dates. But, you know, the people back then, as I look at them, they looked out for you. The foremans I had, anyway, they looked out for you. You know, the people that came to work every day and did the best they could, even when they made a mistake, it wasn't a problem, because the foreman recognized that they were doing the best they could. The foremans had a lot more authority than they do now, but at the same time, they would watch out for you. It seemed like it came across anyway. I never saw a general foreman, or was in an interview with a general foreman or anything. But it seemed like they were a lot harder crusted individuals that had to. Maybe it's because of their position. I don't know, but it. I enjoyed the foremans I had, and I enjoyed, you know, I learned real quickly not to watch the clock. You know, you're doing the same thing repetitively, but as long as you didn't watch the clock, and you came in, you did your job, and you did the best you could, and you were always, you know, you're always proud to see where you were ranked. I took pride in that anyway, seeing where the plant ranked in quality with the other ones. And we were always either at the top or the next to the top. And that was always a good thing for me. I always liked that. And I felt like I was a part of it. It was only a tiny part of it, but I was a part of it.
Speaking of that ranking of the plant, Lansing's been known as the capital of quality. People have ordered cars from all over the country, if not all over the world, from Lansing because of its quality reputation. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, that's a really great question, and I've often thought about that over all these years. When I hear that, I'm going, if we're the capital of quality and the highest of quality, what are these other plants? Because I see so many different things that need to be improved on, and that should be improved on. So that's my first impression of that, but... as far as why we are, I have been told it's because we have such a rural base facility. We've got a lot of farmers that were worked in the plant. And then and the next thing I think that had a lot to do with it is you have a lot of father sons, uncles, cousins that work there. And the thing with it is, it's really difficult, you know, if your dad's banging you on the head to get up and get off to work on time because of the plant depends on it, it's a lot different than not having anybody else being responsible for you. Because a lot of people were hired because of what their father's work record was, or their uncle's work record was. I mean, that happened all the time. If you had a relative that was a poor worker, you had a lot harder time getting in, if you got in. Because they were competitive, just like everybody else. They want the best worker they can for the money they're paying.
Can you describe the age variance of the workers that you worked with in your trim department? Were they a mixed group? Did you hire them with a young group? Did you come in alone? Was there a group of people hired at the same time? Some of these things, men and women, blacks, Hispanics.
The first night that I walked in with, there were six other people that I hired in with that night. And I don't remember who they were or their age group. When I was put on the line down in the body shop at Silicone Bronze, I was given to a gentleman. His nickname was Smiley, and I still see him there for once, a great, great, great while before he retired. He'd come into the hall, and he didn't remember me, but I remembered him. And he was really a good person. I really liked him a lot. I was having a really difficult time learning how to run this. But he would never said a negative word, never said, you know, and he fixed a lot of my jobs that I messed up on, you know, because it was just a real, I can remember the foreman talking about Smiley. He says, you know, he's not the brightest person in the world, but he's here every day, and he does a great job. He says, that's what we pay him for. And I had no idea where he knew him a lot better than I did, but that was, I don't know. It was always a very much of a sore spot to so many of my fellow workers, though, because you would run into the very occasional person that didn't come to work or didn't come to work often enough. And I don't want to say they were shunned, but they weren't appreciated. And they truly were not accepted into the group because they hurt the group. And they couldn't, that happened in both body shop and trim that I was in. Because, you were part of a group that was, you needed to be there.
The line runs pretty fast. Did you find it difficult to keep up? And did people help you keep up?
In the body wires, absolutely. I had just a terrible time. I couldn't figure out why my partner could, it's just like he had magic fingers or something. And he could do the job. It took him 75% of the time that it took me. And I was amazed at that. And he would help. And when I'd fall, I would do things to make up for that. You know, you couldn't expect him just to do my job and his, because I would do whatever I could and whatever needed to be done, and we became good friends. And he hired in after I had, and so he had less seniority. And it was a really sad day when he got laid off, and I never saw him again. Never saw him again. And I often wondered where he's at and what he's doing.
Well, you've shared about your coworker working across from you. Can you describe the environment? Was there women and was there minorities?
There was some women, not very many. There was some. There was many blacks. There were a very few Mexicans. But there was, I don't know if you, I guess you're asking, was there any racial problems?
I wasn't getting to problems yet. I was just curious, was it at all white environment, or was there a mix of people?
There was definitely a
age
mix.
Age groups? And
of course, the age group, the older people were all white. And then there was probably, I'm trying to think. It's been such a long time ago, I can't tell you what the ages were for the blacks and the Mexicans. But there was more blacks than Mexicans, but I just can't put that together for you.
Okay, I just was curious about people getting along of all different age groups.
And there was no problem with that.
And come a time when you felt that they were your brothers and sisters?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The people, especially right around you. I always felt like the foreman was definitely on our side. He had a role to play. Especially the people around me, absolutely. Something would happen, and you wouldn't be able to do a job for whatever reason. And I didn't know what to do. And they said, so you throw the wires in it and let it go. Repair will pick it up. And I said, but the job doesn't get done. She says, that's okay. That's what the repair people are for. And
so what's a repair person? What is that?
Well, it's when something doesn't get done or something gets broke. It goes into the repair bay, and they literally take whatever apart and fix it or put it together the proper way. The thing is, with the body wires, they had to be in because everything goes on top of them. There's nothing that doesn't go into them. It was a difficult job for me because of the speed factor. And when I was down in the grinding booth, then that was not a problem. You grind it and wire brush it and go to the next job. Maybe I should say this too. Back in the grinding booth, it was so noisy. You had all these hand signals because you couldn't hear. That was kind of cool.
Did they provide you ear protection?
Back then, I can't remember that they did. I'm going to say no.
Maybe cotton even or nothing at that time?
I can't remember. To me, they didn't. They must have because I can still hear. But I can't remember them doing that. But then, he'd come up to you with this, and of course you got this hood on, and you can't hear anything, and he'd, make the two hands breaking together. Well, you're on break. Oh, okay. And
just briefly, seeing that you had worked in different environments in the same building, did it ever amaze you that some people, they all made the same wage earned through their bargain benefit of the union, but they all did different degrees of labor, didn't they? Did that ever cross your mind as a guy that would come in and have those pin pricks in the body shop every day to a guy up in trim where they could dress differently and hear and see?
Well, it didn't bother me at all. And the reason being is because they had the opportunity to move. You had the opportunity, as far as I was concerned, if you wanted to become a foreman, you had that opportunity. You might have to go to LCC and take some classes. You might have to put a number of transfers in to different areas, and you might have to wait a year or two or three or four. But you had the opportunity to go to other parts of the plant. So you were given a wage, and you're not made to go to that plant. You're not made to work there. It's a choice. You can choose to do this job, or you can choose not to and go someplace else for employment. And the fact that with that, plus the fact that you can and have the opportunity to move. Now, I'm sure there's some people that say, well, I shouldn't have to wait all this time. Well, then you have to have a system, and you have to have an orderly way to get there. And that's just the way it was.
You mentioned a lot of the work ethic was handed down, father to son and so forth, family to family. Did you have any people or any family members that worked at Fisher Body?
No. None. I was none.
What about after you? Did any come after you?
I have my brother. Well, at first my sister hired in. And then after her, my brother did. And then my brother's first wife hired in.
And did you help them adjust to the factory life?
Well, it's at that time of my life, I wasn't as close to my brother and sister because I had my own selfish interests in mind. And there wasn't a lot that I could really do to help them except for them to show up to work. I obviously don't have a problem doing what I could, but there's not a lot of adjustment there that you can really help somebody with, except, you know, you just got to do it.
Okay. Well, I want to know about your breaks and your lunches. Did you pack lunch? Did you go to the cafeteria? You worked in the cafeteria.
Yeah, I worked in the cafeteria, and I knew exactly what to eat and what not to eat, especially on Mondays and Fridays.
And share with me, did any of the people from the cafeteria recognize you?
Oh.
From
there was a real heated discussions in the cafeteria there, because, it didn't take any time at all, because, you know, the first night that I showed up, everybody went right through the cafeteria that I had been hired in. And, of course, everybody knew what had happened. I mean, they're not dumb, but at the same time, management would say, nope, that didn't happen. There was a 2-week lag here period of time, and that's all legal now. As far as eating my lunch, I didn't like to go to the cafeteria because I knew how it was prepared, first off, and I didn't know how old it was, especially on a Monday. And I did enjoy the fish and the french fries. Now, on Thursdays, I usually tried to make it, once in a while, I should say, I tried to make, because I always enjoyed the fish. They had excellent perch and all the french fries you could eat. I liked that. But outside of that, I didn't. I had a friend that liked to go to Burger King for lunch, and I didn't like that either because you had to run to the parking lot, fly like a bat out of Hades to the Burger King, pick up your meal, and get back. You only got 30 minutes. What I always ended, it didn't take long at all. I brought my meal because line had stopped. I'd sit down where I was at. I'd pull out my lunch. I would eat it probably within 5 or 6, 7 minutes, and I'd lay down for 20 minutes. And line to start, I'd get up, and I'd be right there. I didn't have to rush. I didn't have to go, and I had to pack my lunch, but that's okay.
Well, let's round out that little story, though. You had the bad day. You were missing body wire. You were putting the wrong carburetors on. Did you ever secure that woman that you were in love with?
Yes, we did. I ended up marrying her.
Was she with you when you got back to the Fisher Body Plant?
Yes.
Well, congratulations. Came a time then you had a wagon break of your own. Did you enjoy that 6 minutes? And
I almost never frequented the wagons. Almost never. And the reason being is because I knew about the rats over the pies and the coffee sticks and how everything's made, how clean it was, and I didn't participate.
What about departmental dinners and the holidays? Did you, as a group, do things, and did you participate?
Now, generally speaking, I was laid off during those different times. I got a year and a half seniority into the plant before I was laid off permanently. And it just seemed like it always skipped over those holidays. And I never was really able to participate in those.
What was the... Was there music? Or what did people do with radios and things in the plant? You said it was loud in body.
Body, there was... You couldn't have had a radio there because it was just too loud. There were radios in different places. I know there were, but I don't remember where they were up in Trim. I know they were there, but it just...
What shift did you primarily work, or did you ever work both shifts?
I worked strictly second shift, just about exclusively. Except when the only time I didn't work second shift is when I worked in the powerhouse.
Did you meet skilled trades, and did you have interaction with them, and describe what skilled trades was, or did you ever encounter?
Well, skilled trades, The only real skilled trades people that I really met is when I was in the powerhouse. And there it was just expected that you would become a skilled tradesman over time. Because when one person retired, somebody else moved into that spot, and you at that point started working towards your skilled trades, whichever you're doing. Now, I didn't have a lot of... There is one incident that I remember very well. And this just really didn't have that much to do with skilled trades. But Peabody, I can't remember his first name. But he was a electrical engineer. And he was known as a heavy, heavy drinker. And I remember back then the line never stopped. If the line stopped, somebody got fired. I mean, it was that critical. And at the time in the body shop, I was working on a machine where I put six pieces in, and I hit two buttons, and the welders would come over and weld it, and then would go on into this huge machine. And something happened to this huge machine. And I never had seen so many white shirts in all my life. And there were so many white shirts down there that, and the skilled tradesmen couldn't figure it out, the bosses couldn't figure it out, and they're screaming for Peabody. And about 5 minutes later, which is a tremendous amount of time for that line, here come Peabody walking along. And it was just so cool to watch him look over things nonchalantly. Look at him. He'd crawl up the ladder and hit a few buttons. And he'd take off again. Then he'd come back down the ladder. Nobody bothered him. Because he knew so much and had so much ability that nobody else could do it but him. And they knew it. Nobody bought it. It was just incredible.
Did a skilled tradesman ever do anything special for you as far as help you make something for you that would make your job easier? Or that?
No, nothing like that. When I was in the powerhouse, I was an ash puller. And, of course, the fireman, who is a skilled tradesperson, we were partnered up with. And, it was, there's a lot of interaction there because he was your partner. And, you were responsible. When he would go to lunch or do whatever he had to do to be away from the boilers, he would leave you in charge. And you were expected to know everything to do. Of course, me being brand new, I knew very little. Basically, if this gauge goes to here, or if this gauge goes over here, you blow the horn and you find me. But if I would have been there long enough, I would have learned how to run those boilers to the point that you're actually a skilled tradesman before you have the title, or even,
So early on, you became a union member. Did you attend the union meetings?
No.
How long did you work at Fisher Body when you were rehired into the trim? And you say you till you
see with my, this is kind of fuzzy here because I hired in and I worked in the body shop. I got laid off, went to work at the engine plant, came back and worked in the powerhouse. Got bumped out of that back up into trim. And then from trim, I was laid off permanently. And then, of course, I worked that one changeover in sanitation. What's the question again, Doug?
Oh, I was just curious how long you worked at the plant itself.
I worked a year. I have a year and a half seniority when I got.
Can you remember, did you ever see anyone get hurt?
No, I don't.
What is one of your best memories of Fisher Body Plant?
My best memories? I worked out on the coal pile. And, of course, you drove a bulldozer out there to push the coal around, and you empty the coal out of the coal cars. And then you had to fill the hoppers up for the boilers. And this was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was out there in my bulldozer, and And there's a Y to go from first, to go from forward to reverse. There was a Y, and it wasn't working properly. So you had to hit it just right, or you'd go into neutral, or you'd stay in the same gear you're in. And this coal pile is probably 30, 35 feet high. So you're pushing coal over this edge into this pit. And the accelerator on the bulldozer is when you push down on it, that stops it. But when you let up on the accelerator, there's a spring that's spring loaded, of course, and that accelerated the bulldozer. Well, I'm on top of this hill pushing over this thing, and the thing that is, after you do this enough times, you get to where you can go just to the brink of falling over. You throw it in reverse and you keep going because that's the most efficient way to do it. Well, I'm on top of this coal pile, and I'm pushing wrong, and all of a sudden I put it in reverse, and it didn't catch. And I'm feeling this bulldozer on top of this hill kind of back and forth, just like in the movies, you know? And all of a sudden I start going down. Of course, there's a coal cart down at the bottom of this hill, which would be wedged underneath this, between the bulldozer get wedged between the ground and the coal pile and the railroad car. And I'm going, as I'm starting to go a little bit farther and a little bit farther, of course, I'm trying to get it in reverse, and I got to be careful because if I put it forward, I'm done. And I can't get it in reverse because it's not catching, and I'm gradually going forward and forward. And I says, now, if I jump off of this thing is going to accelerate. And finally, I'm going down the hill. And so I jumped off that bulldozer, and I'm going, geez, I hope this sucker doesn't roll over on top of me. Of course, you know, like I said, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It picked that whole coal car right up. It's then settled back down. And the engine just rearing. Just, and the wheels are, the treads are just digging right in. And it stalled. And I thought, I'm fired now. So I went in town, inside, and went to the foreman. And I told him, I says, his name was Thompson. Not Thompson. Townsend. Townsend. And he says, well, let's go take a look at it. So we got out there, and he and I and another guy spent the rest of the night getting that bulldozer out from underneath that railroad car. And not a word was said. Didn't go any farther. Because he recognized, you know, first of all, it wasn't altogether my fault because I couldn't get it in reverse. But that was fixed the next day.
And did you have to secure another bulldozer or crane to pull?
No, how'd
you
get that? What ended up happening is they have a real fancy come along that they can pull these railroad cars with. In between pulling the railroad car, which turned the bulldozer just enough to free it, so we could back it up the hill. But it took us all night long to do that.
Pretty good wage for making a mistake, huh?
Well, but that was, I was lucky. I could have gotten hurt real bad there.
Well, that's a good story. Do you have a funniest or happiest moment in Fisher Body?
Oh, the happiest was when I got hired in. I was just excited. I was a kid making more money than Dad was, and I could afford at that point to do things for the family. I could afford to buy Mom things. I remember on Mother's Day, I bought her this great big plant. I mean, it was so big, I couldn't get it in the car. And I had to bend it over, it was such a big plant. And, I came home, and of course, I got home at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning and I put in the living room for Mother's Day, and that was fun. And, I felt like I had the opportunity to do things for, being a preacher's kid, we never went without. We never went without, but we never had a dime left over. It was never, in my opinion, there was just barely enough money to cover things. And so I was able to do things for the family. And that was great.
Came the day. What was your, what is, or what was your saddest moment at Fisher Body?
Getting laid off the last time. It was, I remember I got married December 15th. My new bride and I moved into our brand new house December 28th. And I got laid off permanently January 15th. Of course, I didn't know anything about this being laid off until... And so I was out of a job. You know,
with a mortgage payment.
With a mortgage payment, with a wife. You know, it was always said, getting your 90 days might be a little bit hard. You get a year in, you're set. You were set for life. Well, I had a year and a half, and it didn't happen. So that was a real difficult thing.
Well, can you tell us, how did you end up at UAW Local 602, and how did you secure that position?
Okay,
And tell us how you got to where you're at today, then.
How I got to where I'm at today?
Well, here we are. How many years later?
Well, it's almost 31. Almost, not just a few days, few weeks shy of 31 years. I didn't find a job. At that time, they had subpay, but it was considerably less than what it is today.
What is subpay?
Subpay is a supplementary benefit. You would get your unemployment Terry from.
Did the company just give you that?
Oh no, that was from the local, from the union. It was a required. They every hour you worked, X number of cents was put into this kitty, and you worked with it. But I got laid off on January 15th. I worked for a farmer. I worked for a contractor. All under the table. And then I didn't find work until November. And foundry. That's the worst job I've ever had in my life. I would never wish anyone to work there.
In a foundry or in Charlotte?
In a foundry. Charlotte's a fine little town. Nothing wrong with Charlotte, but that foundry is Johnson's Iron. And that was just, you know, I still got a scar on my leg because of I had just had a tear, but that molten metal was so hot, it burned my leg. In the same shape of that tear. And it was so filthy dirty there. And I worked in there till... Well, I hired in November. The following, I want to say May. Bruce DeLand, our family friend, was made mention that the custodian at Local 602 is retiring, and that I should apply. And I said, "Well, Bruce, I don't know if I have any shot there." He says, "Well, they're looking for somebody that's worked in sanitation. Have you worked there?" I says, "Yeah." They want somebody that's worked in maintenance. I says, "Well, I worked in the powerhouse." And he says, "Well, that's good." And he says, "They want somebody that's got a real good job record." And I said, "Okay." So I applied, and I was told there was 50 other people that applied for the same job, but they didn't meet all exactly the criteria. And Bruce, being so active in the union, I'm quite sure that had a plus two. But I got hired in, and... You know, it's been almost 31 years. I figure I've got at least another 8 years, if not 10 years, to go before I retire.
And how many different presidents did you work for?
I'm under my seventh president.
How do you view the union, and did you ever become active in the union?
Okay, now as far as being active in the union, I can't be active in Local 602's union official activities. I am minorly active in my own personal union, yes.
And which union would that be?
It's Local 42, OPIOU, out of Detroit.
And what does that stand for?
Oh, wow. I should know that.
Oh, it's OPEIU, yes. And it's the Office Professional Employees International Union. Thought I'd help you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So you do belong to a union, and now you became active in your union?
To a degree. I've been the union steward for our local for the last, I want to say 6-7 years, maybe a little longer. Going to union meetings is difficult because you have to go drive to Detroit, which is 90 miles into Detroit. So that's this, and I go to at least 3 or 4 a year, especially lately.
Yourself and our office staff are our union members working in a UAW facility. What's that like? And just describe what it's like to work in a union hall. Are the people, there's a lot of people come through. Was the union looking, always said it was thugs and stuff. Describe the union to someone that doesn't know anything about unions.
A union is nothing more than what the general population is. You have really good people, you've got really bad people. The biggest misconception of a union is that people feel that when they pay those union dues that they're absolutely guaranteed a fair shake. And that's not what a union can do. The union gives you the opportunity of possibly getting a fair shake. And that's what you're actually paying for. Just because you've been done wrong by management doesn't mean the union can correct that. But with a union, you have the possibility of it being corrected. But that idea is absolutely missed by the vast majority of the why don't I get this representation? And assuming you get the rest has poor abilities, he's elected, and so that's what you're going to get. You're going to get a person with poor abilities. If you elect a person that has a lot of ability and a lot of drive, that's the type of representation you're going to get. So the onus really goes back on the membership to elect quality people. But
which is done through a
nominating period and then through an election. The 80%, 90% of the people that are elected to these offices in the local are very, very good people. But I remember one time there was a individual that was elected to his own position, and he made the blank statement the next day. He says, "Don't bother me for 3 years." And that's what happened. For 3 years, he sat on his butt and didn't do anything. At the end of his term, he wasn't reelected, and he went back to the line. And now that's an extreme, extreme situation. By far and away, there, what happens is you get individuals that really want to do well and want to try hard and you know, do well. And it's hard to be
do
critical.
Do well, you mean to... What do you mean by do well? To do what?
In any type of a management union position, there's only so much that a... first off, there's only so much that a committeeman can do. Now, he can take care of a lot of things, but at the same time, if management doesn't want to move on some areas, or maybe they have a particular grudge against a particular individual, that there's only so much he can do, so he would bump it up to the zones, who have a little bit more, I guess I want to say influence, because they don't have any more authority, but they have more influence. And then, of course, it goes to the international from there. But it bothers me that so many people don't pay attention enough to the people that they elect. Of course, you can see the same thing in our national elections too. If you paid more attention to what we're doing, we would get better people in office.
Okay, you are still a union person. They have benefits through the collective bargaining process. What's your most appreciated bargain benefit?
The health coverage, without a doubt. The health coverage has saved Both of my boys had asthma real bad when they were little. They burned up nebulizers, which is a basically what that is a little air compressor that pushes air through a tube, which goes through a medicated device that aerosols it so that my boys could breathe it. We burned one of those up. We used it so much. Being in Wyoming, not Wyoming, being in Montana, and Trevor having an asthma attack, walking through the door to the hospital, flashing the card, Pam and Trevor going one way, and I going to the admitting desk another way, never hearing of anything else of Bill. It's incredible. You know, I hear all these horror stories about how, you know, people are left out in the gurneys because they don't have health coverage. I do my best not to abuse the system because I appreciate the system and I don't only want to use it when I need it. In fact, I've been criticized heavily by my wife, but I don't use it enough and frequently enough because of different issues. But I'm going, I would rather do that and not abuse the system. By far and away, the health coverage is absolutely critical. To me, that is as important as the hourly wage. I mean, you take a person that's got really great health coverage making $10 an hour is really making more than the person making $15 an hour that doesn't have health coverage. You know, that's just my opinion.
I'm going to move into your community quickly. We have a little bit of tape left here. Are you active in anything outside of your...
I'm reasonably active with my church. I've been on what they call a vision team. Since January, and this vision team is literally planning the future of the church, or at least we're giving the ideas of the direction that we feel, and then the church is put up for a vote, and then we go on. Our church is going through quite a growth spurt, and you know, my Sunday school class that I'm involved with. I try not to talk, so I do very as little more, so I don't dominate the conversation. My wife sits on me sometimes because, you know, they ask me, I'm going to tell them. Don't ask me if you don't want to know, you know. But other things that I've been really active in, my boys were Cub Scouts. I was a Cub Scout leader, and then I was in the Boy Scouts, and I was on the council of both the Boy Scouts and the Cub Scouts. In fact, I was the awards chair, which is a horrible job to have. Don't ever be that in the Cub Scouts because it's just giving out hundreds of awards every month and trying to keep them straight. But I was really glad to be involved with the Boy Scouts.
Is that giving me?
Yeah.
We got that much time.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. You're helping the kids there. Did any of your skills carry over that you've used at on your job on a day-to-day basis into your community, or do you do anything with the skills you've got as far as the maintenance person at Local 602 outside of here?
Well, the church uses my abilities to a certain degree as far as repairing things. What's the old saying? You're knowledgeable about a lot of things, but not master of none. I can't remember. Kind of paraphrasing it there, but that's basically what I am.
So you've helped out there. Do you run a business on the outside of the plant?
I have a very small carpet cleaning company on the side. I've run that for 28 years now, and it's I enjoy it a great deal. The job that I have right now doesn't really push me very far mentally, and I enjoy a great deal of dealing with, especially the clients that I've had for so many years. And I was just commenting earlier today that I've watched so many of these parents grow older as their kids grow older. And, I've run my little business for about 28 years now.
David, I'm going to finish this up with asking you, you've seen the good years and the bad, and you've seen the Fisher Body Plant, as we know it, come closed a year ago, May 5th of 05. What's it feel like to see the place coming down?
It's hard. It's really hard. There's been so many changes that I've seen. so many new parts of the plant being built, and now it's not going to be anymore. It's it's very much like a funeral, only a piece at a time. I just wish they'd get it done and over with.
Do you have a message for people that are going to learn about the auto industry from these tapes and this message? What would you tell young people of the future about work ethic, or what do you have to say?
The people that I see that are the most successful are the people that at work the hardest. We have a president right now, Art Luna. He works himself literally till he's sick. And he's the most effective, the most dynamic president that we've ever had in the years that I've been here. I used to think that Richard Sanborn was the best president that we've ever had. Well, as much as I love Nick, Art is by the best president we've ever had. As far as a message is that for the future, education doesn't guarantee you anything, but it gets you in the door. And without it, you might as well forget it. It used to be a college degree was really important. Now you can't even hardly get in the door so many places without a college degree. And if you don't have a high school education, you might as well forget it. I mean, I would say just work hard. Do the best you can at whatever you're doing. Be true to yourself to the best of your ability. And find God.
Well, that was an excellent interview, David. We thank you today, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Dave.